Capital Region, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunlight. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start with part one of an interview I did with Troy DSA about his electoral efforts. Then we talked to Iyad Al-Kharabi, a member of the local Palestinian Rights Committee, and about an event this Sunday. Later, for Election Watch, Corinne Carey spoke with Ann Coonrad, who is running for the position of family court judge in Rensselaer County. After that, Sina talks to White Feather Hunter, who is a multiple award-winning Canadian artist and scholar, and about our upcoming Ruderal Ecologies 2 conference. And then finally, playwright Chisa Hutchison speaks about her play Dead and Breathing, which will be playing at Albany Capitol Repertory Theater starting October 14th. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that finding affordable housing for refugees remains a problem in the Capital District. Albany expects 400 new refugees this year, in addition to over 100 Afghan refugees quickly being resettled in the area. Citizen Action said the group is experiencing what low-income residents in communities of color in Albany have been experiencing for decades. The lack of affordable housing has only worsened. One difficulty is the cost of repairing houses in low-income areas. This often exceeds the worth of the area housing, making financing very difficult to obtain and afford.
The Time Union reports that 10 people have been arrested on weapons possession charges following a mass shooting in Albany at an unpermitted private club called The Lounge, allegedly an after-hours bar in West Hill on Saturday that left an Afghan war veteran dead and six others injured. The 10 individuals were inside the club when the shooting occurred, and two handguns were found on the premises.
The U.S. will reopen its land borders to non-essential travel next month, that is with Canada. So ending a 19-month freeze due to COVID-19 pandemic, and as the country moves to require all international visitors to be vaccinated against the coronavirus.
Governor Hochul says while the state is unlikely to replenish an excluded workers fund with another multi-billion dollar pot of money, she did not rule out working with state lawmakers heading into the next budget season to come up with more money, as well as to find ways of boosting employment among needy people who do not qualify for federal pandemic relief. State of Politics reported that advocates and state lawmakers are pushing for the fund to be replenished with available money now and potentially add $3 billion next year. They point to recent flash flooding this summer from the remnants of Hurricane Ida affecting low-income and immigrant communities.
The Daily Gazette reports that an employee of General Electric has filed a lawsuit against the company and its union, alleging he was fired from his union position for calling attention to his supervisors and others' alleged improper conduct.
That's it for headlines.
And for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear? Well, we'll find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
For our first segment, Troy DSA, that's a Democratic Socialists of America, are endorsing three city council candidates in Troy this November. Mark talks to Troy co-chair Mark Speedy.
We're joined by Mark Speedy, who is co-chair of Troy DSA Democratic Socialists of America. We're going to do a two-part interview with Mark. In this part, we're going to focus on what the DSA is doing in terms of the upcoming elections in the city of Troy this November. And then a little bit about some of the, divisions, say, within the local Democratic Party and how the DSA might fit in that. So, Mark, why don't you just give us a brief introduction to, you know, Troy DSA? I think most people probably have heard of DSA at this point. And then who is Troy DSA supporting locally in Troy?
Troy DSA is a branch of the, or a chapter rather, of the Democratic Socialists of America. And we're basically an organization dedicated to, promoting socialist ideals like fair housing and racial justice here in the city of Troy and in Rensselaer County at large. We have four endorsed candidates in this election cycle. So for Troy City Council, we have Kiani Conley-Wilson in District 5, Marquita Edwards in District 6, Danielle Collin-Charleston in District 1. And then we also have a county legislator and candidate, Alex Flood, who is for Skodak and Nassau and that general area.
So why don't we briefly go through the candidates? Marquita Edwards is, particularly interesting. Apparently, a longtime African American activist, lost the Democratic primary, but has a working families party line. What attracted DSA to Marquita?
Well, Marquita is a really great candidate with a really inspiring story. So, Marquita is first and foremost, she is a mother. She is a grandmother. She is a Black woman. She's someone who has struggled with addiction and homelessness in her lifetime. She has overcome those things, and she has used the energy that she took from those experiences and turned it into helping other people. And that's what she's done working with other nonprofits in the past and with starting her own nonprofit that's focused on, helping people overcoming addiction and getting rehabilitation after bad experiences with our justice system. So she is heavily aligned with us and, a lot of the ideals that we stand for.
District 6, could you maybe, what part of Troy is that? And is, particularly one or two key issues for Marquita?
Yeah, so District 6 is South Troy, and it contains a lot of racial minorities in Troy. So racial justice is a really big part of her platform. I think that one of the key points of Marquita's campaign and the reason that she decided to continue running on the Working Families Party line is because, she is not trying to take votes away from the Democratic establishment, typical voters. She is trying to be a voice for those who do not typically engage with politics because they felt that it doesn't represent them. So she is, she speaks for a lot of the racial inequality in the area supports a lot of police reform and things like that that are important to a lot of the minorities in that area as well.
Now, a second candidate, Kiani Conley-Wilson, I believe she has both the Democrats and the Working Family Party line, but also three candidates in that race. Where is she running and, why Working Family Party decide to back her?
Yeah, so Kiani is, she's in District 5, which is East Side and Little Italy, that general area. Kiani was at one point a co-chair of Troy DSA, and she's still an active member. She's a tenant, she has a lot of really great experience, actually. So she works for Soul Fire Farm, which is an organization that's focused on solving food injustice. It does a lot of farming experiences, helping people learn how to grow their own food. She has been active on City of Troy environmental boards. And so she's really focused on a lot of environmental justice, clean food, clean water, all that kind of stuff. While also being a very active socialist and activist in our community.
Now, the last candidate, at least in the city of Troy, do Alex Flood down there in Scodafra County Legislature. Dee Collin Charleston, was she up in the more of the north part of Troy? Or what's correct. Her Dee Collin sign? I should mention, actually, Dee Collin had been in the past a producer here at the Media Sanctuary. So we do know Dee quite well.
Yeah. She's great. She's representing District 1, which is North Troy, Lansingburg kind of area. Like you said, she's been a producer on radio. She is an artist. She's a poet, and she's an activist. She's been very active in the Black Lives Matter movements, calling for police reform and things like that. She's also been active in the Friends of the Mohicantuck campaign to save a sacred forest in that district. I feel like she's like very well known and liked in the city of Troy. She has been like the opening poet for a number of Troy city events, even ones put on by the city itself. So she's wonderful, and we're happy to have her on our endorse list as well.
Now, for our first segment, we have about 3 minutes left, talking with Mark Speedy, co-chair of Troy DSA. So perhaps end up in this first segment. What was Troy DSA trying to accomplish, or is trying to accomplish, in this election cycle? And what were some of the criteria you guys used in making the selections that you did?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a few key issues that we really look for and really try to support here. The first one is housing justice. So we strongly believe in more public housing and more affordable housing. And that includes not subsidizing private developers. So the city of Troy really likes to give handouts essentially to these developers because they promise to build new housing. And then they build some luxury developments that only really wind up going to our wealthiest residents. We really want to support candidates who believe in housing justice and the right of people to have that shelter. We also really look for racial justice. As I'm sure you know, last year we had a very large Black Lives Matter protest in the city of Troy. We had thousands of people coming out and marching in the streets. And I think, it was astonishing, really, seeing how the Troy City Council currently responded to that, which was barely doing anything at all. We had the mandatory police reform committee, which truly came out with basically no noticeable results. And so we really wanted to see candidates who would support those ideals as well. And lastly, we wanted to make sure that these candidates were people who spoke for the working class, people who supported labor unions, were not just the wealthy homeowners and, the Democratic establishment candidates who seem to have held these seats for a long time.
So in the last 45 seconds, my guess is you probably would love some volunteers, additional volunteers to help. How people best get a hold of Troy DSA if they're interested in participating?
Yeah, you can shoot an email to info@troydsa.org, or you can check us out on social media on all platforms as Troy DSA.
We've been talking with Mark Speedy, co-chair, DSA Troy, particularly Marquita Edwards, Kiana Conley Wilson, and Dee Collin Charleston in the city itself, and Alex Flood, Southern Part County Legislature. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So that was part one of our interview with DSA. Both of them are already up on the mediasanctuary.org website, so you can listen to the second segment, which will air in a couple of days. But now we turn to an event coming up, sponsored by the Palestinian Rights Committee. Jonathan Kutab is a co-founder of the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq and co-founder of Nonviolence International. He's a well-known international human rights attorney. He was the head of the legal committee negotiating the Cairo Agreement of 1994 between Israel and the PLO. He will speak at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, 10 North Main Avenue in Albany, on Sunday, October 17th at 2 p.m. We're joined by Iyad Al-Kawderbi, who has been an activist since 2006 and credits his political awakening to the signing of the original Patriot Act. He is a Palestinian, Syrian, American, pansexual queer. Iyad graduated from SUNY Albany, where he majored in political science with a concentration in global politics. So welcome, Iyad, and maybe you could explain why are you bringing Jonathan this Sunday to Capital District?
Good afternoon. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me, folks. Mark and Andrea and Sina, you guys are amazing. Thank you so much for having me here. Mark, you and I have been knowing for each other for a long time in the environmental movement. Mm. So Jonathan Kutab is also currently the executive, the new executive director of Friends of Seville North America, which is a Palestinian Christian theological civil rights group. And since he's since he took it over from another Christian theologian, Tariq Abu Atta, he finally decides to come up here. Finally, people like known Palestinians are starting to come up to the capital region again. Because you know, I've been trying so hard to get some known speakers up here, and it's working. It's overdue. I think it's amazing that we're going to have him. We're going to have him speak at St. Andrews. And we are looking for members of the press to be there. We're looking for, we're probably looking for other co-sponsors still.
I was just interested in this event coming up on Sunday at 2 o'clock. What's the focus of this event? Is there a particular avenue you're traveling through on this to focus on?
He's probably going to be talking about many things in Palestine, right? He's probably going to talk about what's it like being a Palestinian Christian. Currently, there is a bill protecting, currently there's a bill that Israel is getting $3.5 billion to put people in, put kids in cages. Now it just got up to four. Yeah. It's stuttering and I'm like paralyzed that like Israel's got more money to put children in cages. And mainly he's going to talk about so many things. He's going to talk about what's like being a Palestinian Christian. What's it like being a part of Friends of Seville North America. And basically he's going to be talking about the Palestinian Christian situation.
Now, there has been a new, I guess, election in Israel a while back, new head of the country, even though it still seems radically divided. Any sense that anything's going to improve in terms of how, you know, Israeli treats Palestinians, especially in the occupied territories?
Things are not going to get better. Things are going to get worse. As I recall, You and I, Mark, had several conversations way back when. I think either in 2008 or 2012 and eight. And 2008 and 12, we had conversations about a known defense minister. He was a minister. I don't remember if he was defense minister or minister of education, but Naftali Bennett is a known war criminal. Naftali Bennett, Avigdor Lieberman, and Ariel Sharon, they were part of the worst human beings on the planet. horrible, horrible, horrible people. These are the type of people that would cast my people, the Palestinian people, in other category, sub beneath humans. You see, what would happen is they would categorize us as solely in green, basically. And a lot of these people would believe that and treat us as such. You know, when the 2014 atrocities happened in Gaza, there were a bunch of people who were enjoying the rockets coming down in Gaza and seeing the rockets being destroyed and seeing all these Israelis launching the Iron Dome and the Israeli officials launching rockets, completely decimated Gaza. You could see a lot of these officials sitting, cheering, cheering. This is the type of category of power that Israel is currently going into right now. Those type of folks voted in Naftali Bennett, and Naftali Bennett is of those people, is of the settler question, is of exterminate and ethnically cleanse the Palestinian people out of existence. So this is possibly the extermination phase of my people. Having people like Naftali Bennett, having people like Avigdor Lieberman involved, having power is concerning, upsetting, and hope there's hope. All there is to talk about is building a BDS movement.
Well, I mean, you're bringing Jonathan Kitab in to speak, and not only is he a well-known Palestinian human rights leader, but he also co-founded Nonviolence International. You know, what are some of the ways that they're trying to pursue, you know, nonviolence challenges, I guess, to the present Israeli government?
I guess the best way to challenge nonviolence, to work on a situation with nonviolence, is protesting. The protesting that people do in Nabi Saleh, the protesting and living life. At the same time, what does nonviolence or violence mean in the eyes of a Palestinian? My breath is violent. Mm-hmm. Olive trees standing in the winds, bringing breath of life, bringing fruit, bringing oil, is violence to the colonizers. Jonathan Kitab is breathing. It's violence. So we need to get out of the root cause. What is colonialism? What is settler colonialism? We're standing on stolen land as well. So I just want to reset the conversation on what this V word means. So I think what happens is that they do a lot of tours. They show a lot of people the other side what's going on. Basically, mainly I believe we're gonna do a lot of great work. I'm really excited that he's part of the leadership of Friends of Seville North America, because Friends of Seville North America does some amazing work. I was part of several conferences that really dipped into the intersectionality of the Black church and the Arab church, and the intersectionality of BLM, the Black radical tradition, and the fight that us Palestinians do each and every day. So we got a lot of work to do.
So we're out of time. Palestinian Rights Committee, Jonathan Kitab, speak in St. Andrew's Episcopal Church Sunday, October 17th, Sunday, October 17th at 2 p.m. St. Andrew's is at 10 North Main Avenue, Albany. If people want to find out more about the Palestinian Rights Committee, how can they do that?
Contact us on Facebook and or get a hold of me, my first name and last name at gmail.com, or get a hold of Tom Ellis. And if you're interested in joining the Palestinian Rights Committee, you can hop on our calls. We have them every Tuesday, every other Tuesday.
And what's the website for that?
ThePalestinianRightsCommittee.org. That's an old website. We got to update
Brilliant.
It. Get with us on Facebook.
Okay, lovely. Thanks so much for joining us. So we'll see you then October 17th at 2 p.m. at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Albany.
And for those just tuning in,
I'm Andrea Cunliffe, and you are?
Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the beautiful sanctuary of independent media, Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge Munsee community.
And this program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. So next up for our election watch, Corrine Carey spoke with Ann Coonrad, who is challenging sitting judge Jill Kuhn for the position of family court judge in Rensselaer.
Coonrad, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to take a few minutes of your day and my day to talk a little bit about my race.
You're seeking the role of family court judge. I'm curious to hear what motivated you to run for this position.
Well, I have spent my entire life helping others, starting with being a nurse. I've been a registered nurse for 35 plus years, worked at Samaritan Hospital for about 30 years, 20 of which was in the emergency room. So as you can imagine, I've seen a bit of life in the emergency room. You are helping and caring for families and children, oftentimes during the most stressful time in their life. I went to law school mostly because I was involved with the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am. It's known as the acronym SANE.
SANE, that's right. Nurse. Some people don't know that. So I was the first coordinator. As I said, I was an ER nurse, and one of my responsibilities was to assist with those exams, those forensic exams. And I just remember the first time I had to do that, it was very disheartening that, number one, here is someone who's had a traumatic experience, and the folks caring for her had to read the instructions as we were going about the exam. So I thought it could be done better. And when the program was first introduced at Samaritan, I was all on board. So that experience, the 4 years of coordinating, hiring, training nurses, led me to law school.
Can you describe to our audience what kinds of matters family court judges deal with on a daily basis?
Well, for the last 6 years, I've been over in family court as the court attorney. Primarily, I would say my experience is mostly custody and visitation, but certainly family court judges hear cases regarding a neglect and abuse of children. And I think that as the family court judge, you have to be able to identify children that are at risk. You have to be trauma-informed, which I think that I am. Juvenile delinquency, family offense petitions, adoption, and some support. The support magistrate really makes those determinations, but if there's an objection, then the family court does review what the support magistrate has done.
Other than your work in the family court as a lawyer and your ER experience, what other experiences have you had in your life that make you uniquely qualified for this position?
Well, I mean, after I graduated from law school, I was a prosecutor for a couple of years. So I prosecuted domestic violence cases. And then the last 13 years, I've been the court attorney at Troy City Court. And that means that I research, I analyze complex legal issues. I know where to find the answer about the law. So I think that having some practical experience, helping others, interacting with individuals and families and children, and having that legal background where I know how to find the legal answers, I think that will serve me well.
Do you think that race plays a role in cases that come before family court judges?
Well, I have to you know, just sort of put out there that any discussion about policy is sort of tricky for judicial candidates because we're prohibited from making any statements that might impact the impartiality of what the judiciary does. You know, I think that anyone who interacts with the public has to have cultural competence. There's diversity in our community, and you have to be culturally competent in order to make these decisions. I think that my life of interacting with the public and also being an educator, I've been an educator of nurses. So I think that those experiences and that background have made me culturally competent. I'm certainly not an expert at it, but I'm aware of it, and I would continue to be mindful of it.
What are the three most important qualities you think that a family court judge ought to have?
I think that you have to be able to interact with folks from all backgrounds because you're making important decisions that impact their lives. You must be even tempered and patient because oftentimes people just want you to hear. That was my experience when I conference cases with litigants and their attorneys. They just want to be heard. So I think you have to be very patient and allow people to speak. But then you also, I think it's important to be able to have the wherewithal to make those difficult decisions based on the facts and applying it to the law.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Anne Coonrad. Ms. Coonrad is a candidate for family court judge. This interview is part of a series of interviews that we're doing with candidates seeking public office, and it's part of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Election Watch 2021 series. Do you consider yourself someone who applies a strict interpretation of the law or someone who believes in interpreting the law?
Well, I mean, as a trial part, you do have to follow precedent, but there's a lot of precedent out there. The facts are always unique, so you have to really take that into account, what facts you have in front of you. I mean, there's some hard and fast rules, and the precedent is what it is.
Where can we find you when you're not on the campaign trail?
If I'm not out campaigning and meeting folks, I live here in Troy. I have four children that are grown. My husband and I raised our children here in Troy. We're lifelong Rensselaer County and Troy residents. And my grandchildren are very important to me, obviously. So I spend a couple times a week. You know, the girls come over to have dinner, even Elizabeth. So that's certainly one of the places you can find me is with my family. They are the bright spot in my life. They're part of the reason why I want to be able to help all the children of Rensselaer County and the families of Rensselaer County. And I think that my background, my professional background and my practical experience and the fact that I've been a lawyer for 15 years, I think that I would bring something to the table for the families of Rensselaer County.
It strikes me as odd that judges run under different parties when judges are expected to apply the law in ways that are not ideological. How do you explain the fact that, you know, you're running as a Democrat, your Republican is running as a Republican? How does that play into your role?
I really don't think that it does. I mean, judicial positions are nonpartisan. Upstate, we're elected. Downstate, they're appointed. The truth is that you have to have the support of the party in order to be on the ballot. But these positions are non-political.
Ms. Coonrad, thank you so much for taking the opportunity to talk to me about this race.
Oh, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
So Corinne Carey is trying to interview all the candidates in the city of Troy in particular. You can go to our MediaSanctuary.org and search for Election Watch, and all her various segments will come up.
White Feather Hunter is a multiple award-winning Canadian artist and scholar working in a research, craft, and performance-based transdisciplinary practice. She specializes in biomaterials research, used predominantly to develop new critical discourse.
I'm White Feather Hunter. Hunter is my last name. I am a bioartist, a witch, and an academic researcher. I'm currently working on my PhD as a doctoral fellow at the University of Western Australia. However, I've been stranded back in Canada for almost 2 years now, thanks to COVID, and attempting to continue my research in whatever ways I can, although I don't have lab access right now.
So you mentioned that you're a witch. So on your website, you say that you work in performance. That's a term many of us understand. So is craft-based work part of your witch practice? And could you explain how that comes across in your work?
Yeah. So both the performance and the craft are sort of intersected with the witchcraft practice. I have a background in textiles as a textile artist, and my textile work has often, other than the obvious connections to witchcraft, such as weaving and spinning and, you know, fate, I often like to include the performance of craft or the activity of, you know, constructing things with craft methodologies as a sort of ritual practice. And often my performances are not for a live audience unless they are participating in the ritual. They become performance videos. And those videos are both artifacts, you know, of the performance and of the craft process. And when I say craft process, I include performing laboratory protocols as well. There's a certain craft to that. So, you know, the performance becomes this didactic sort of enactment of process. So it's not what you would typically think of as a performance-based practice, maybe.
There is a large cross-section of the sciences and the creative mediums in your work. You often use creative mediums to present your scientific research, and you use scientific approaches to address creative ideas. So how are both science and the arts important to you? And how would you argue that arts funding, or would you argue that arts funding and science fundings should be equal?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. And that's a very political question. So I'm working often with scientific methodologies, not necessarily towards exclusively scientific outcomes. I'm working towards conceptual outcomes, cultural outcomes, and, you know, towards inspiring or engaging people in critical dialogue about the role of the sciences, about the ethical pitfalls or the ethical conversations that need to happen around new technologies. So, you know, specifically, I work in biotechnology, and that is both microbiology as well as cellular biology, and specifically tissue engineering. These fields are used industrially. And so, you know, as an artist, I want to have a conversation about what that means when these biotechnologies are scaled up to an industrial level. How do we think around those? How do we even begin to address the issues that can erupt if we don't have an understanding of the complex processes and implications, you know, of microbes and genetic modification and, you know, tissue engineering. So I'm exploring those things. Most of my funding is through the humanities, or it's arts funding. And that is, you know, simply because my accredited background is in the arts. So even though my PhD is a cross enrollment between two schools at the University of Western Australia, it's through the School of Design and it's through the School of Human Sciences. So it's both a design and a science PhD. Because my outcomes are not specifically focused on scientific outcomes that an industry can use, my funding comes from the arts. Now, do I believe that those should have equal importance? Yes, absolutely. And I believe that there should be a lot more conversations happening between artists and scientists, or between people working in the social sciences and the hard sciences, you know, because without those conversations, people who are trained in the hard sciences, you know, and I'm talking specifically about biology or physics, what have you, aren't often equipped to engage in really complex, critical cultural discussions. So rather than serving as an artist who's just here to communicate scientific outcomes, I'm an artist who's here to use scientific methodologies to instigate complex conversations.
As an artist, I know that the overlap of the science and the arts are well received in the arts world. How is your work received from the science world?
It really depends on the scientist.
Yeah.
I I have a lot of issues working through all of the bureaucracy around experimentation with unconventional materials, let's say. So I use a lot of body materials that come from my own body. And there are, you know, ethics, human research ethics approvals that need to be acquired, even if the only human I'm working with is myself. So these things become these protracted, problematic processes that are, you know, I'll say narrow-minded for lack of a better word, only because, like I mentioned before, people who are trained in the hard sciences aren't equipped to view the sciences through another lens, which is the lens I'm using. So what happens is that I become subject, you know, academically or institutionally to a lot of what I consider to be bureaucratic harassment. So these are bureaucratic processes that ultimately shouldn't even be necessary. But, you know, here we are. Now, when I'm working or collaborating one-on-one with a scientist, those scientists are often really curious, open-minded people. And, you know, they want to engage with experimentation through that different lens. So, you know, in that way, I've had really rich and rewarding experiences collaborating with other scientists. So, you know, it really depends.
And experimentation is really what science is. Let's just make that
mark. Exactly.
So the word ruderal refers to the plant species that are first to populate disturbed lands. Are there ways in that you see your work working off this premise or adding to the conversations about our environmental movement?
Yeah, very much so. You know, so I sort of have two streams for my experiments. One is where I'm in the laboratory, in a biolab. And then the other one is where I'm using the landscape as a laboratory. And I do not see an ecology from a compartmentalized view. I think that's a very, you know, colonialist, capitalist perspective to see the ruderal maybe as just a plant species, because those plant species would not exist. They would not grow and thrive in any environment, including human wastelands, if they didn't have the microbial species there to support the nitrogen uptake that are required. So there are all sorts of symbiotic relationships that happen around the plants, you know, these ruderal species. So I work a lot with the other species that are sort of part of this interconnected web, mainly microbes. So I've gone into environments such as, you know, gold mine tailings, and looked at which microbes might actually be able to thrive in this toxic waste. I've gone into other environments that are, you know, tree monocultures, for example, and looked at what species are able to thrive in this essentially human wasteland. So my concept of the ruderal is tied specifically to a geography that may be negatively impacted by human industrial practices, and looking at, you know, not only the plant species that are there and thriving, but the entire ecosystem, you know, interconnected with and around those plant species, drawing, of course, on my scientific background in microbiology.
What else would you like to have a part of this conversation? What did I forget to ask?
So one of the things that I'm always, you know, hypercognizant of when I'm working in any ecology is, who are the first peoples of this environment? How can I understand the cultural implications for the indigenous communities that are either surrounding these devastated ecologies or trying to work within recuperation or bioremediation efforts of these ecologies? What are the stakes? You know, so I'm always in conversation with the local indigenous communities. And I feel that that is, you know, one of the most important aspects of my practice. And it's also one of the most politically charged and problematic aspects of the work that I do. And I often find myself kind of butting heads with the industry people who are around these areas, you know, whether it's governments, whether it's federal governments, provincial governments, or even just the academic community that has a stake, you know, in the projects, in these environments, there's always really interesting problematics that come up. And so I'm very committed to engaging with, you know, consulting with and including and respecting the Indigenous communities of any environment that I'm working in, even if part of the feedback that I get from the elders or from collaborators is, don't do this project here.
Thank you for joining us, White Feather Hunter. You will be one of the guests for Rural Ecologies 2. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
So White Feather will present her work on the last day of the conference, which takes place October 22nd to 24th. And you can visit themediasanctuary.org for more info and to register for the virtual event.
Playwright Chisa Hutchinson spoke with Corrine Carey about her play, Dead and Breathing, which will be playing at Albany's Capitol Repertory Theater starting October 14th for 10 days.
Chisa, thank you so much for joining me. I'm excited to talk to you about your play.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you about it.
Your play is going to be at the Capitol Repertory Theater, and it is called Dead and Breathing. A very provocative title. Can you tell us about the play?
Right. So Dead and Breathing is about a kind of cantankerous woman of a certain age, we'll say, who's pretty well off and by all appearances, you know, should enjoy her life. She's, you know, again, very wealthy and has had access to so many different kinds of opportunities that other people don't, and lots of resources. But she's pretty miserable, largely right now because she has been diagnosed with stage 3 uterine cancer and, you know, has been struggling. And so they actually assigned her a hospice nurse. She'd gotten pretty far along, but she's been in hospice now for 2 years, right? Which is not exactly, you know, not exactly hospice. So she's trying to, you know, figure out what is going on and just wants to die already. So she's petitioned her hospice care nurse to assist her suicide. And this is nurse number, I think, 16 or 17 who's come in because no one else wants to help her with this and be legally liable. So yeah, she's pretty determined to end her own life because she's not enjoying it.
What motivated you to write a play like this?
There were a few things sort of nibbling away at my brain before I sat down to write this play. The first is I actually lost my mother, one of my moms, in 2011 to ovarian cancer, which spread. And, you know, I took time off work to go take care of her down in North Carolina where she was. And it was really one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And it was really hard seeing her so debilitated. You know, she was just such a vibrant woman before this cancer took hold. And, you know, we were talking about putting her in a hospice facility, but she was really, really adamant about not going. And she just wanted to die in her own home. So that was heartbreaking. That was one experience. I also have an aunt, Veronica, actually, who's I based the nurse in the play on my aunt Veronica, who is a nurse, and she did work in hospice for a really long time. And she's just one of the funniest people. She just has such a dark sense of humor. So I've just always been really struck by that, of how this person who, you know, encounters death so frequently is just one of the funniest freaking people I know. So, I mean, she was a huge inspiration for the play. And then also I've just been dealing with, I think a lot about quality of life issues myself because I have multiple sclerosis, and there are some days that are better than others. You know, some days I'm a little more limited than I am on others, and it's frustrating. And I think all the time about how, man, if this progresses far enough, like where's the line, right? Like where, you know, if I where's the line that if I cross it, I just don't think I could keep living anymore. So yeah, those are the three things that were sort of working on my spirit while I was writing this play.
Well, it sounds like your aunt as an inspiration. Death and dying, it's a hard thing to imagine in a play. I mean, certainly there are a lot of plays that show dying scenes, but to write a play that's around death and dying, you kind of have to imagine that there might be some levity, and it sounds like your aunt was a perfect inspiration for that.
She is, and she gets a kick out of the fact that I wrote a character based on her. She actually flew out to the first two productions. She flew out to the Contemporary American Theater Festival in West Virginia, which is where it had its world premiere, and was like a celebrity because everyone there knew that the character was based on her. She made sure everybody knew. It was just really nice to have her there and soaking in the love. Yeah, man, everybody loves Veronica. She's like really just one of the dopest people I know.
What was the reception from the audience like in West Virginia?
I was actually kind of shocked by how well it was received, particularly in West Virginia, because I mean, the play, it's about two Black women. You know, there are two Black women at the center of it, and they're just very, I mean, just demographically speaking, very different from the folks who live in West Virginia. So I didn't know what to expect. And this was, you know, my first play out there. So I really was kind of surprised when I got people. Yeah. So the characters in the play, you know, they're two Black women. They're, you know, in a sort of metropolitan area. And it's not a demographic that I thought you know, folks from West Virginia would be able to connect to. But there, I'm telling you, like, there's death and dying and, you know, mortality and morality and all of these issues are issues that everyone really, you know, everyone at some point deals with. And cancer in particular, I feel like everyone knows someone, right? They've lost someone really dear to them, or maybe they're dealing with it themselves. It's a stew of just universal experiences that I feel like everyone can, they know what that stew tastes like, right? They know. So I think everyone was able to, enjoy is kind of a weird word to use when you're talking about a play about death, but I think everyone was really able to connect with it on some level, and that was very encouraging.
This is not the first play you've written. You're actually a celebrated playwright. Are all of your plays this deep? Do they all deal with current social issues? How would you characterize yourself as a playwright?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I tend to center people of color or just generally marginalized people in my plays. And I've really tried to make it more about how people who live in a society that seems so bent on denying them joy, like how they can find joy for themselves, right? I think that's probably the common denominator in my plays of, you know, how do you snatch joy from a world that is like really stingy with joy?
And what are you working on now?
I've really been pivoting toward film and television like a lot of other playwrights I know. The pandemic really sort of took theater out of the mix for a little while, but I have been doing audio plays and TV. I'm in my second TV writer's room right now. The first one was Showtime and this one is for Hulu, film stuff.
Is it super secret or can you share what you're working on?
I'm not sure. Well, I know I can tell you that I worked on Three Women for Showtime, which was an adaptation of Lisa Tadeo. Her book, it's an incredible book that she spent almost a decade really researching the desires of women, the sexual desires of women, and what compels women to engage sexually with people who, you know, maybe they shouldn't. Or like is maybe not so healthy for them. That series we're in pre-production for that. So we're still casting, I think, for that, but it's all written up. Yeah. And then for Hulu, I'm working on Tell Me Lies, which is also based on a book. It's a novel. Oh, and I'm premiering my first feature film is premiering October 22nd. It'll be available on iTunes. It's called The Subject and you can pre-order it now. And it stars Jason Biggs and Ajahnue Ellis, Annabella Costa. And it's another one of those gray area pieces, you know, that explores morality in a way that I think doesn't present easy answers.
It sounds really exciting. Well, I have to say, I can't wait to see this play. I'm so grateful it's being performed in our area. And I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity to speak with you.
Yeah. Oh, and likewise. Thank you.
Unfortunately, speaking of death, I should probably note that two longtime icons of the Albany activist community passed away the last few days. Darby Penny, longtime peace advocate, particularly on El Salvador, Central America, and also well-respected as a professional in the mental health community. And then Lou Ismay, at 96 years old, and a leader in many different communities, interfaith, peace, and environmental justice. The play will be October 14th to 17th and October 21st to 24th at the Lauren and Harold Iceland Studio at Capitol Repetit Theater. And it is by Chissa Hutchison, directed by John Remy Monet. And for more information, you can check out www.blacktheatertroupeupstateny.org.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Our engineer is the ever multitasking Sina Basila Hickey. This program is produced allegedly entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our stimulating virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. Be prepared for an icebreaker. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
And tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear your local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.